when you ask what it's like, it's me taking my son to every prison you've been to. From the beginning, he was born January 11. You were taken on February 14th. That's 1 year and 1 month. And it's not something that I take lightly, because I drug my son to the example he had as a grandpa to prison. For 20 years, I did that. Every place they moved you, I drug him. In the snow, in the heat, it didn't matter.
That's Bayon Washington from Compton. Her father, Fulton Washington, was convicted of a nonviolent drug crime in the 90s and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. After nearly 20 years behind bars, President Obama granted him clemency. The scene you just heard is from a documentary about him called Mr. Wash. It was released earlier this year. And we talked to Fulton and his daughter when the film came out. Well, the criminal justice bill the Senate passed last night is aimed at cases just like Fulton Washington's. The First Step Act includes the most substantial changes in a generation to the federal prison system and sentencing laws. It's expected to pass in the House and to be signed by President Trump. We've invited Fulton Washington back to our studios to talk about the bill and its potential impact. And Fulton, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here.
We also have Marianne Levine on the line. She's a congressional reporter for Politico, and she covered the vote last night. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Marianne, to start with you, could you run down for us some of the highlights of this bill?
Yes, the bill marks the greatest biggest overhaul of the criminal justice system in decades. Among its provisions are incentives for some federal inmates to earn time credits if they participate in certain programs. It reduces the disparity between sentencing for crack and powder cocaine, and also eases mandatory minimum sentencing, among other measures.
And negotiations over this took more than a year. So what were the sticking points?
That's right. The negotiations were constant between Republicans and Democrats. Obviously, this is a bipartisan bill. One of the big challenges towards the end of the negotiating process was whether or not Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would eventually bring the bill to the floor. He said last week that he would do so, but that only came at the urging of President Donald Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner. And it was unclear up until last week whether or not this legislation would actually be up for a vote in the lame duck session.
Fulton, you've been involved with the efforts to change minimum sentencing law. So what's your reaction to the Senate's reform package?
It's something that's long need to be done. It should have been here a long, long time ago, because it should never have take 21 years to address the issues that had me wrongfully incarcerated. This bill is going to help a lot of people, provided that they, you know, they do the right thing and stay out of trouble. I'm a little bit concerned with the bill. Understand that this is the first step. So I'm looking for what's going to be step two, because there's a lot of things that need to be addressed in step two and three. You know, you have a lot of people who's incarcerated for quasi nonviolent crimes that's trapped with a life sentence. So I'm expecting that it's going to bring that down to 25 years and they'll be able to come home. But at the same time, you have to look at people who, like myself, I spent 21 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit. My family suffered immensely behind that incarceration. When you compare the federal law to the state law, that you need to have some type of compensation, some way for the people that's in the federal system that's innocent. You have a lot of people that's innocent of their crimes who maintain their innocence, but the way the system is structured now, there is no addressing or redress to it.
Marianne, as Fulton just pointed out, this bill is called First Step. So what's likely or what's slated to be a second step?
It's possible in the next Congress that lawmakers look at more at other provisions for sentencing. But it seems like another area that's a potential where we might look at is punishment for marijuana use, and whether or not there will be a broader push for legalization on that end. I think that's something that Senator Gardner had pushed for yesterday as being attached to the First Step Act. So that's one area where we could potentially see some movement.
Well, Fulton, in the time that you spent in custody, in federal custody, you took advantage of programs that were offered in prison. You told us that the last time you were here, you learned to paint, right?
Yes.
Became an artist?
Yes.
Mr. Wash?
Yes.
This bill seems to try to do a better job of providing educational and training opportunities. So do you have impressions of the current programs? Maybe you could tell us what's currently available and what could be done better.
Well, this is, I'm looking at, okay, this is the first step. They're going to modify the sentencing scheme for a lot of these inmates. They're going to run into a lot of, not they, some of the inmates are going to run into some serious problems, like myself. I was inside of the system, and I wanted to learn how to use a computer. They came out, the internet came out, but I was caught in a situation that, according to the way the policy was, that if I was not within 5 years to my sentence, educational programs was, I couldn't participate in them. You could only participate in specific programs when you within a period of release. I don't think that's really part of what they need to fix. They need to fix that. You got to allow a person the opportunity to learn at every event. Any person that's who, and the argument they made for me was this, you ain't going to never get out of prison. You got a life sentence. So you don't need to never do the computers.
So your experience, how common do you think it is currently for federal inmates to be able to do what you did, which is really you learned a skill, you changed your life.
It's not really common in the road that I came through. They have an opportunity to join, say, hobby shop programs, but there's a limited number of inmates that could do it. You got 1,000 and something inmates, but the facility only hold room for 20 to 30. And if you're in there for a long period of time, 20 or 30 years, and you stay in there, all the other people come in, they're going to never make it in. So you only can be in the program when somebody comes out the program. I went through that wait. I had to wait a long time to finally get a seat. And then once I got a seat, my journey and my path went a little bit different because I continued to give back. And we opened up another room, and I started to teach art. So that
at your urging, you mean?
At my urging, yes. That allowed other inmates that were similarly situated to come in and have a seat. And that was consistent through all three prisons that they put me in, through Leavenworth, through Colorado, and also there in Lompoc here in California. So the average inmate, a lot of them don't get a chance to make it into these programs because they're not big enough. It's not enough energy or resources given to these programs for that path. And when I speak about the path of being art, this art is not just wholly on painting. You have people who are writers, who need programs for writers. You have people that have a talent as far as acting. The federal don't have a course in there for people to study script writing, to study behind the scenes, to operate the cameras. It's a lot of different things that people are interested in that they need to know in order to, when they come out into society,
to get a job. Yeah.
So in my thing, where it was a lot was offered, I had to create my own. I had to look at my own life and say, okay, look, eventually I'm going to get out of here. What am I going to do when I get out? I'm going to be 50-something years old, I thought. I end up being 60-something. But the point is I had to make a conscious decision on what I'm going to do with my life going in. So I had to fight for education. Then I spent my time practicing.
Well, Marianne, turning back to this bill, it did bring together these unlikely allies from just all over the political spectrum, including the group backed by the conservative Koch Network, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the White House. So unlikely bedfellows, how did they manage to transcend the current mood of hyper-partisanship?
I think this is the result of years of advocacy. I think that there's been a bipartisan acknowledgement that the criminal justice system has many issues and is quite broken, frankly, in many ways. And so I think that coming at it from different perspectives, whether it's a social justice perspective and combined with a desire also to ensure that government resources are effectively used, I think that those goals go beyond ideology in many ways. And I think that the fact that this has been worked on for so long, particularly by Senators Durbin, Lee, and then Senator Grassley eventually getting on board with the legislation, I think that there was this common acknowledgement that this was a problem that everyone could see regardless of their party.
And as far as the timeline, it looks like a certain thing that the bill will pass the House and will be signed by the president.
That's accurate. It sounds like the president, from my understanding, will be signing this into law on Friday, assuming it passes the House, which everyone predicts it will.
And Fulton, are you going to go on advocating for change as you have been? And what will be your focus?
My focus at this point going forward is to try to shorten the time to get to the ends. You have a lot of people in here that, you know, when you go in there, you got to wait 5, 6, 8, 9 years. It takes you 2 months and you're convicted and you're locked behind bars. Some cases might run a year, but even at 2 months, it's still going to take you 5 years to come out. And it shouldn't, you can't have an open, big, wide open gate when you create these nets for drug, war on drugs or whatever you're doing, you just grab everything. At some point, you got to take the fish and separate them from the sea urchins. And it shouldn't take, that should be done when you bring them out of the water when they first get in. So we have some problems in the criminal justice system that goes on in the courtroom that really goes to the investigation. You know, not to question, you don't want to question the way that the person come in and just take for granted, which I understand, you know, system have to have some type of boundaries, but you just take for granted that everything is true that's written without an investigation. So you starting from that point and the people never get a proper opportunity to be heard. Now, the law is written that it happens, but it don't happen the way it's written.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much, though, for joining us again. Thank you, okay. Fulton Washington.
Okay.
Mr. Wash.
You're welcome, Barbara.
And thank you, Marianne Levine, congressional reporter for Politico.
Okay. Thank you.
Coming up, the best surfer in history claims he's built a machine that makes the best wave you could ever shred. Riding Kelly Slater's shockwave. That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Well, every morning, just over a mile from where I'm sitting, actually, surfers wade into the cold ocean water and patiently wait for waves. What if that could all be replaced by a pool? Kelly Slater has long been considered the greatest surfer alive today. He teamed up with a group of engineers from USC to design a machine that could create not just any wave, but a perfect wave. His perfect wave pool is far from the glittering coastlines of Southern California, or for that matter, the glittering coastlines of anywhere. It's outside Fresno in the small town of Lemoore. William Finnegan wrote about Kelly Slater's surf ranch for the New Yorker magazine, and he joins us now. Good to talk with you.
You too. Glad to be here.
So what is this idea, a perfect wave? What does it look like, and what are its characteristics?
Well, perfect wave for surfing would be different sort of for every surfer. I mean, my idea of a perfect wave would be different, for instance, from Kelly Slater's perhaps. But this wave they've created with this machine in Lemoore, California, and planning to build other pools all over the place, it's about head high, maybe a little bigger. It's got different settings. So there's a beginner setting that's quite easy, and then on up to a pretty fast hollow, as we say, like a wave you can actually get inside and need to go very quickly to make, and it gives a pretty thumping wipeout if you don't make it, and it's very, very long, 700 yards long. That's nearly a minute for surfing. That's an eternity. So it's this absolutely fantastic wave. I mean, it's probably the best wave most people have ever seen.
Well, help me understand why Kelly Slater, of all people, who's been, you know, traveling the world for the past 15 years just chasing beautiful, perfect, natural waves, why does he, of all people, want to create this and possibly change the sport of surfing so fundamentally.
It's true that Kelly Slater has probably got more good waves to himself than anybody else in the world in the last 30, 40 years. But he had this fantasy. He'd given voice to it in a memoir in 2003 about, you know, wanting to create a machine that would make a perfect wave. And he actually acted on it. I mean, he went to USC and found some engineers, one guy in particular, Adam Fincham, who understood what he wanted to do and came up with an idea that worked in the lab. They worked for about 10 years on this thing in secret. It was kind of, you know, can we do it, you know, because it's there sort of thing, I think, with Slater. It wasn't because he doesn't get enough waves in the rest of his life. But, you know, all surfers spend a huge amount of their lives chasing high-quality waves, including Kelly Slater. And so his idea was, what if you could just have it, push a button and have it?
And what's the science behind it? Because I think you say in the article the math is diabolically difficult.
Yeah. Well, this fellow Adam Fincham, his idea was to create a soliton, which is a solitary wave in water that is kind of surprising. It propagates without losing energy. But still, nobody had ever tried to produce a soliton in a wave this size, you know, surfable by grown people with a lot of power. It's just, you know, mathematically horrendous. They ended up having to run sort of parallel supercomputers for weeks on end, just trying to figure out where every cell of water and air needed to be. And they're pushing the water with a hydrofoil, that is a kind of blade they're running through the water beneath a vehicle on a track along one side of the pool. And it's remarkable to me that they could figure out a way to shape this hydrofoil in a speed and an angle that would create this incredible wave.
And is that what you want for a perfect wave, one that is steady, or don't you want unpredictable things to happen?
That's a great question, because on the one hand, this idea of the perfect wave, which has been around, you know, since I was a kid in the 60s, and basically never happens in nature. I mean, the cliche is, you know, not a drop of water out of place, but there's always a drop of water out of place, or a lot more than a drop. You know, waves are these kind of violent events in nature. They're not these stationary, perfect things. But now with this machine-made wave, it's much closer to this idea of everything exactly as you would want it. And the funny thing I discovered while reporting this piece was that they immediately changed it. They decided, that is Slater and his partners, that it was too perfect. You know, they wanted to make something that you could surf more, that you could perhaps have a competition on, where you can show what you could do. So it needed to have some variation, as you say. So they changed the bottom, the bathymetry of the pool. It makes a lot of difference and basically determines how it breaks. So it's got slower parts and faster parts in different sections, modeled on different waves in nature.
What are the implications of this, then, this invention, for both the sport of surfing, the amateur sport of surfing, the professional sport of surfing, and also for things like wave pools, which, you know, places like resorts and water parks already have wave pools, but I imagine this is just going to 11 now.
Yeah, this is a whole different thing. I mean, wave pools have been around for a long time, including, you know, pools meant for surfing, but until now, they've only created these, you know, quite short, messy, rather weak waves and weren't really that interesting to surfers. But this thing is completely different. I mean, no surfer, no matter how you feel about it, a lot of people object to it. I mean, there's a sort of spiritual challenge almost involved in this, like a push-button great wave. You know, what does it mean? You know, it's not in the ocean where we sort of spend our lives and devote ourselves to.
Yeah, it's so against that spiritual Zen element of surfing, you know, human against the water and or part of the water, becoming part of the water. It kind of really rubs the wrong way that way. I surf a little bit.
Well, it does rub a lot of people the wrong way. And yet, virtually everybody who surfs, including me, who sees this thing says, oh, I don't, you know, whatever they have to say about it, you know, it looks great, or it's a nightmare, it's dystopian, it's soulless, it's mechanized.
I think you say in the article it's like sex with a blow-up doll.
I didn't come up with that one, but I was discussing it afterward. What was this, you know, if you get the chance? Because it's not been open to the general public. I mean, I got to write a couple of waves, and other people have got to write a lot more. Just if they're friends of Kelly's or they're pro surfers or they're celebrities of some kind, or they've got a heck of a lot of money. I mean, they rent it out to groups privately for $50,000 a day. And they don't produce that many waves. You know, sort of 15 an hour is the most that they can do and maintain the quality. So it's not really clear how many of these things they'll be able to build. If you just open it up like a ride, you'd have to charge so much for each wave because the electricity to create this thing is enormous, the amount of power needed. And, you know, staff, maintenance, everything, they don't seem to me to have a model yet to make this available to the public. So the fantasy that these things are going to be built all over the world, bringing surfing to, you know, Kansas and you know, Lithuania is, I think, premature. Yet they've already got plans. I mean, they've got permits to build in Japan and Florida, and they said they're going to build them all over.
Well, you gave Kelly's Wave a try. How did it work for you? How did it feel?
It was kind of nerve-wracking. I mean, I just got a couple of waves, and yeah, I was just trying to figure out what to do. Don't fall off, don't fall off. There's this big machine running down. It's not like any other wave you've surfed. I mean, it is really, really good, but it's just you can't look ahead and see what it's going to do. You're surfing quite close to a fence, surfing at the fence, and you never get to it. But that's a little distracting, I found. And the waves kind of be made up under your feet as you go. You know, in the ocean, say you're surfing a point break, a place like Rincon or Malibu in Southern California, you take off on a wave and you look down 30 yards, 40 yards down the line, down the coast, and have an idea of what you need to do and what's awaiting you. This is not like that at all. It's just like being made under your feet. So you almost have to remember like where the hollow parts, the hard-breaking, fast sections are from having observed it. And of course, once I was on there, I couldn't remember, like, where am I? I can't tell, you know, when's it going to barrel? When's it going to jump up? What's it doing now? So I was often, you know, I'm cutting back when I should be hurrying. I'm hurrying when I don't need to. And I fell off, got wiped out right at the end by a sort of hollow section at the end. And I popped up just thinking, Let me do that again. I know what I did wrong. So, not a religious experience, but exciting, and leaving you really hungry. I felt like an addict, you know, begging for another hit.
Well, I would love to try it if I could ever afford it. Thanks so much for this, William.
Oh, my pleasure, Barbara.
New Yorker staff writer William Finnegan. You can read his story about Kelly Slater's wave pool in the new issue of the New Yorker. Coming up, what director Josie Rourke wanted out of a scene where the rival queens and Mary, Queen of Scots, meet face to face, a meeting that probably never happened in real life.
She essentially wanted it to be like a sort of Renaissance heat. So Pacino and De Niro in skirts meeting in a cabin.
Actress Saoirse Ronan is here. That's next. Don't press play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. The usual version of what happened between Queen Elizabeth I and her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots, goes something like this. England is Protestant under Elizabeth's rule. Mary grew up in France and is Catholic. The two are bitter rivals. When the people of Scotland rebel against hot-headed Mary, she appeals to Elizabeth for support, only to end up suspected of plotting to kill her cousin. She's then decapitated in perhaps the most botched beheading of all time. Well, the new movie, Mary, Queen of Scots, explores a more psychologically and politically nuanced take on the story, that perhaps Mary and Elizabeth were affectionate cousins who wanted to forge an alliance, but were pushed to conflict by the power-hungry men around them.
My dear cousin Elizabeth, I hope we might meet in person, that I might embrace you. But ruling side by side, we must do so in harmony, not through a treaty drafted by men lesser than ourselves.
My dear cousin, Let our nations cherish each other as we would, two kingdoms united.
How did the world come to this?
Mary, Queen of Scots is directed by longtime theater director Josie Rourke, and it stars Saoirse Ronan as Mary and Margot Robbie as Elizabeth. I spoke with Saoirse Ronan earlier. The first thing I noticed about the film really is your presence, that you have this bearing of a queen, and your posture is so erect and straight, it almost makes everyone else look a little smaller than you or a little beneath you or more mortal.
Yeah.
So it made me wonder, and maybe it's just the corset you had to wear, but how much did you think about the physicality of this part of playing a queen and how a queen carries herself? And is that something that really gives you an in to mastering this role or any role that you do?
Yeah. The physicality always makes a difference, and it's always something that I put quite a bit of thought into, and just, you know, in a very sort of organic way, but just allowing yourself to tap into who this person is physically and how they would move. And we also had Wayne McGregor, who is this fantastic choreographer who's based in the UK, and he's sort of renowned all over the world for these very like avant-garde surreal pieces of dance that he choreographs. And so he worked with us on the film, and he really was my way into Mary, because I had so much knowledge being thrown at me through the books that we were reading, and, you know, historians like John Guy that were coming in to give us all this information on the period and Mary in particular. And you can become so sort of absorbed in all of that that you forget about the heart of the person, and really sort of need to treat it like it's any other fictional character. And Wayne was really great at sort of just getting me out of my head and helping me to really embody who this girl was. So,
like, what did he say or what did he do to that helped you?
Well, he choreographed sequences. So we did exercises where, like, I would walk into a room and I suddenly need one of my handmaids. And if I look a certain way, does that mean I want one in particular? Does that mean I want all of them? What gesture do I give when I decide against all of that? You know, it was just about given that a bit of consideration. So
So interesting, because they're supposed to anticipate your needs. So that is part of what being a queen is, right? You don't even have to voice what you want, or people just react to you.
It's just about exercising that sort of power, you know, and doing that through your movement is a really powerful, effective way to do that.
Well, Mary, Queen of Scots gets a kind of a bum rap, I was thinking, in our school books.
Yeah.
You know, she's made out to be this woman who's led more by her emotions than political savvy. And I had no idea that she advocated religious tolerance, which is very clear
she
in the
did,
film.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. She was a Catholic queen, and Scotland was a newly reformed Protestant country. John Knox had really taken hold, or was on the way to becoming as influential as he ended up being. And he was obviously a very strict Calvinist. So she had a lot to sort of fight against. And yet when she came home, she really encouraged everyone to be able to practice very freely whatever religion they wanted, and expected for it to be the same sort of case for her. And she was met with so much animosity about that she couldn't practice Catholicism in public and had to do it in her private chambers in case she, you know, got attacked or something. So she was met with an awful lot of aggression from this other side.
Well, honestly, full disclosure, all I knew about Mary, Queen of Scots was that she had the most botched execution in all of, I think, English history. It's a horrible story. How much did you know about her story and this relationship with Elizabeth when you signed on it? And did you have to revise what you knew?
Yeah, I was sort of the same as you. I had a vague idea of what had happened to her, and assumed that she was, you know, she was just painted out as this femme fatale, you know, in every history book that you would read as a kid and throughout school. And I also kind of knew that because of where those tellings were coming from, that it probably wasn't true, because I know, you know, even in Ireland, the way history's been portrayed by other countries, it's been a bit warped, as it has been at home as well. It always is. So I knew there was more to the story. And then once I started to read John Guy's book, you know, I was given this sort of wealth of knowledge about who Mary was and what type of a person she was. And I think the thing that probably surprised me most initially was just how kind of politically astute she was.
Do you think it might stand with my honour to marry my sister's subject?
It is true that an earl is not a prince. Surely there can be no greater honour than to match yourself with a nobleman by whom you inherit such a kingdom as England.
I have such inheritance by blood, regardless of who I marry or do not marry.
She was very smart and very strategic, and she knew how to play the game. And, you know, she had grown up in the French court, being very close to the King of France and her two uncles, who one was a military man and one was part of the French court. And so she was around them a lot growing up and, you know, wasn't completely clueless to how things are run.
And there are obvious feminist themes running through the film. The men are trying to control and manipulate the women in charge and to take their power away or turn Elizabeth against Mary or Mary against Elizabeth. Did you shoot this pre or post Me Too? And was Me
pre.
Too... So pre, so that wasn't part of your thinking. Do you think the movie might have been different in any way had it been made later? Whether that would have been part of your conversation about these women?
No, I don't think it should have been part of the conversation. I think it needed to be something that was sort of organic and came from a place of emotion more so than anything else. You know, we wanted to make a film about people and the high points and the low points of a person in authority and a person with power and how that affects them and the people around them. And I think that's something that we've all come into contact with in some shape or form sort of throughout our life. So it needed to come from an emotional place and not a sort of political place. I think that you can make a stronger statement in film by coming at it from a really human point of view and not going, okay, I need to sort of tick this box. So... yeah, and but it was a really interesting thing, obviously, after we made the film and I started publicising Lady Bird and Margot had I, Tonya out and then all of these stories came out because that, you know, obviously became a huge conversation. So it was really interesting that we had just made this film. It was obviously subconsciously there for all of us that we were very aware that women were just getting to a stage where whoever had been in that position was a bit sort of fed up. So, yeah.
Well, I mentioned the film takes some liberties with history, and one big example is that Mary and Elizabeth, as far as it's known, never met face to face, and they do in the film. Can you talk about that scene? What Josie Rourke told you, what kind of notes she had for you about that scene and what the intent of it was and the thinking behind why to have it?
Yeah, I mean, Jose had said to us early on she essentially wanted it to be like a sort of Renaissance Heat. So Pacino and De Niro in skirts meeting in a cabin after the war. No, but it's that whole notion of like of an audience watching two characters follow their own path and be so connected to one another without actually meeting and finally give them the satisfaction of having these two characters in the room at the end. And I think, you know, we totally took artistic license there, but I think it's one of those things that like everyone knew it probably didn't happen. It could have happened and it just hasn't been recorded. We don't know. It was a very long time ago. And yeah, and I think it was, you know, in the way you do when you adapt a book into a script, sometimes you need to go, well, you know what, this is what a film audience needs. And it was this very sort of satisfying thing to finally get to do. And I think they're both at a point, especially Mary, where she's at breaking point, you know, and this Elizabeth is her last hope.
Do not play into their hands. Our hatred is precisely what they hope for. I know your heart has more within it than the men who counsel you.
You would do well to watch your words.
I will not be scolded by my inferior.
Your inferior.
A And Mary has been trying for years to get the two of them in the room together. And Elizabeth has, you know, had a lot of people around her telling her no, but has also been quite intimidated, I think, by a meeting with Mary, because she knows how sort of open and charming and fair Mary is. And so for all those reasons, it became this very sort of emotional day for the two of us. And, you know, when we finally did get to see each other, that was as we were shooting. We hadn't seen each other at all for the first half of the scene, where we're on either side of the washroom. And when I pull back the sheet and I finally see her face, that was the very first time I had seen Margot in the flesh as Elizabeth, and the first time she had seen me, because we had stayed apart throughout rehearsals. And so the adrenaline that came from that was like nothing I had ever experienced on a film before.
So you had never seen Margot Robbie in that makeup that she wears, and
no,
in that bright red wig that she's wearing in that scene.
No.
So that was a natural reaction on your part of shock. What was your reaction when you saw that makeup?
I was shocked. And what I saw was a queen who had really had to protect herself from the people around her, and even in a way from herself and what she might want as a woman and as a person, and had turned herself into a statue and something that sort of couldn't be touched. And another reason why we thought it would be so effective to have the two women in the room physically together was to see their appearances and how starkly different they are, and to see how they had both been pushed to this. So Elizabeth, by the men around her and the pressure that she had been put under since she had become queen, had pushed herself into a situation where she became this empty shell of what she used to be. And Mary went the other way and went into battle and fought and was headstrong, and she lost.
Well, looking ahead, you're reuniting with Greta Gerwig, the director of Lady Bird, next, and you're going to play Jo in Little Women, another strong young woman who struggles for self-determination and to get a foothold in a world dominated by men. Have you watched any of the other adaptations of Little Women, or do you stay away from other performances?
I haven't watched them since we started. We've wrapped now, but no, I had watched them growing up, and I had read the books growing up. So it's been really amazing to get to play someone who's so beloved and is so sort of admired in literature. It's amazing.
Well, are you feeling like you'd like to play a villain sometime soon? I mean, you're so wonderful in Atonement.
I'd bloody love to play a villain. I'd love to do that. They get all the best scenes, and they probably die at the end. So you have this like brilliant death scene, and you've got the best lines, and you look really cool, and it's great. So I'd love to do that.
Well, I wish you the best with this film, and I really wish you a villain part and a really juicy death scene.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Saoirse Ronan. She plays Mary Stuart in the new film, Mary, Queen of Scots. Coming up, these days Saigon is lit up like Christmas Tree Lane. We continue our series of holiday traditions around the globe with a look at how the Vietnamese and Vietnamese Americans celebrate the season. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Now we're going to continue our series on Christmas around the world. Today, Vietnam. It's the native land of our producer, Amy Ta. Vietnam is largely a Buddhist country, so you wouldn't expect Christmas to be much of a thing there. But as it happens, Vietnam celebrates Christmas in a big way. Andrew Lam is a journalist based in Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City. He's author of the book Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora, and most recently, Birds of Paradise Lost. Andrew, it's good of you to join us.
It's good to hear from you.
So just how Christmassy does Saigon look right now? What kind of decorations are up?
It's over the top. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco, and I would say Saigon beat San Francisco in terms of celebrating.
Oh, and San Francisco is no slouch with Christmas.
I know, but it's quite something else in my native homeland, because it's even if you're Buddhist or Muslim, Christmas season is a big deal here in Vietnam.
Right. So are you talking lights and those things on light poles like Santa's, or what do you see?
Every shop has something up, and the condo where I live now, they put up Christmas tree in every section of the building. The receptionists are putting on Santa's hat, and my God, they play American Christmas songs like nonstop, even more than in America.
Well, help me wrap my head around this, because I was looking up the percentages of the demographics in Vietnam, and I saw that only about maybe 8% of the population identifies as Christian. So
yeah.
Are people celebrating Christmas even if they're not Christian?
It doesn't seem to have a religious connotation for Vietnamese. It seems to be a feeling good season. And I think in some way it's intriguing for Vietnamese because so many of our traditions are based on sadness, I would say. I don't think Vietnamese even celebrate birthdays until recent times. And I remember big celebration has to do, well, used to have to do with death dates. Like in Vietnam, you know, grandma's death date is remembered and we cook big meal and we sit around and commemorate. And same thing for grandpa. But birthday is forgotten, you know. And so in some way, Christmas provides the alternative where everything is optimistic and feeling good.
And how did this happen? How did Christmas become such a big deal?
It's been there for a long time. I mean, the French did come and they did bring the tradition of celebrating Christmas. But when I was a child during the war, it was nothing compared to what we have here today. It was sort of a quiet affair. And I grew up in the small city of Dalat where we would cut the little pine tree and decorated by hand. But now everything, you know, you can buy from store to tinsels to baubles to, you know, you have it. And then the music at a supermarket, and I say, God, this music is driving me nuts. As I feel suicidal listening so much of Christmas songs. And the whole line got really upset. And they say, what are you talking about? Christmas is the only season where we're feeling really happy and cheerful.
So, all right. So lights and you said trees. Do people also give gifts?
Nine yards? No, that's the fascinating thing is that it's not yet a tradition where you buy gifts and give it to each other and to children. So it's not a highly commercial in that sense. But it does stand in contrast to old traditions of, you know, like Vietnamese celebrating the date of the death of kings. And there's a kind of sadness to that, whereas this kind of foreign invasion of Christmas seems to give them this completely optimistic narrative, that sense of celebration. And I have a feeling that it does come along with a sense of economic growth. There's a large and viable middle-class population. They see Christmas in some way as an optimism in their own lives, too. It has very little to do with religion, from what I can see.
That's wild. It seems they're taking the best of Christmas and translating it to the Vietnamese culture. Now, I know you were born in Vietnam and you moved to America when you were 11. So did your family change their holiday traditions when they moved here?
I remember when we got to America and we were quite poor at the end of the war and, you know, struggling to get into middle class in America. But the moment we did get that 5-bedroom in the suburb and live American dream, of course, we started buying gifts. And then when my brother's kids came along and they've done well, you know, and go belong to country club, of course, you know, it's all about the gifts. So you know, we got to America and we got really into the consumeristic impulse. Whereas as a child, I remember Christmas has been just lovely and quaint.
I don't think you're alone. You know, our producer, Amy Ta, is here. And Amy, I want to welcome you into the conversation.
Hi, Barbara. Hi, Andrew.
So nice to have you in front of a mic. So does Andrew's experience of the holidays sound familiar to you?
A little bit. So I came here when I was about 4. And my family, we actually celebrated Christmas. It was pretty big. It was like my favorite holiday when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And
so huge with gifts and
everything. It was
stockings.
I mean, I think it was largely led by one of my brothers, my oldest brother, Jonathan. And so we had a tree, a fake tree, lights around the house. There were a lot of presents. And on Christmas Eve, everybody would get together, including the relatives. We would all sit around the tree and open presents one by one and show everybody what we got. And it was really fun, and we would take pictures of what we got.
Oh,
I remember.
It sounds so great and so American.
Yeah. But I got money. Like, I got an envelope with cash in it for Christmas. And that's what we do for the Vietnamese New Year.
Yeah. Right. They're little envelopes that you buy. And you, So it was all about more about cash and less about the.
Cash is just really easy. So you can just buy whatever you want.
Even when you're six, it's exciting. So, but Lunar New Year was still the big celebration for your family? So that's what you held on to. How do you celebrate that?
I mean, as I got older and my brother moved away, he's in Maryland now, it seems like we just don't really celebrate Christmas anymore. But we do celebrate the Vietnamese New Year, which is in February. And so that is just a really big dinner. And then, as Andrew mentioned, how we commemorate relatives who've died, there's a little bit of a prayer to them, too, during the New Year.
Do you have a kind of an Elijah thing, a seat for them, or a...
We have kind of this altar above our chimney. There are pictures there, there are candles, and like little bowls of rice, and so, yeah.
And what do you eat at New Year?
So, for New Year, there's some like special holiday food. Biggest one is probably, it's called banchung, which is this square shaped, it's pretty big. It's sticky rice with meat stuffed in the middle or sometimes beans. And
wrapped in a banana leaf?
Yeah.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah. And I actually, growing up, I always just liked eating the rice. Sure. I didn't really care for the filling. I just liked the, you know, the sticky rice. And there's actual, you know, the more traditional sticky rice where, you know, the yellow one with mung bean. Or the white one with peanuts. And there's also like a red one. It's kind of sweet. It's pretty nice.
So you don't do the Christmas tree anymore, but is there any kind of tree involved, like the money tree?
So for New Year,
woven trunk?
Yeah. The money tree is pretty cool looking. We had a money tree. When we first got it, it was really small, but now it's actually pretty big. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then sometimes my sister, we had this big tree like in the living room, and it's supposed to bloom on New Year. And my sister would joke that, well, I don't know if she joked, but that if it doesn't bloom, then it's going to be a bad year.
Did you believe her?
No.
No.
It was just, but it was funny, you know.
So this is for good luck. It's this tree, and it blooms, and that's wishing a good omen for the coming year. Huh. And the Vietnamese have zodiac signs, animals, right, too, that are assigned to each year. So what animal is coming up in 2019?
So it'd be the pig.
The year of the pig, we have to look forward to. So, Amy, how do you say Merry Christmas in Vietnamese?
You can say it a couple of different ways, but I would just say Chúc bạn giáng sinh vui vẻ.
Nice. And Happy New Year?
And Happy New Year is Chúc mừng năm mới.
Okay. I wish you both. I'm going to leave it to Andrew to wish it back to you.
Chúc mừng giáng sinh is how we usually say it as well, but... just like happy holiday, happy Christmas.
Well, thank you both so much. This was really interesting. I appreciate it. And I do hope you have a lovely holiday season.
Happy holidays.
All right. Thank you, Barbara. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you. Amy Ta, she's producer on Press Play. Andrew Lam is a journalist and author in Saigon. And thanks again to both of you. I have never heard this in my local CVS, but Christian Bordalis here.
If you were hanging out in Saigon, you would be hearing it all the time.
I know, it's great.
Well, you talked earlier with the wonderful New Yorker writer William Finnegan, who sounds kind of like a waspy New England intellectual, I would say. But
say shred or bro or any of that stuff.
I guess
gnarly.
He's a big surfer, and he wrote this story about the perfect wave, not in the ocean, but the one that Kelly Slater has created up in a giant pool up in Fresno. It's got me wondering about our listeners and whether they surf at all. So I put out a little Twitter poll, and taking the Venn diagram of Press Play listening Twitter users who responded, we got 2% who say I surf all the time.
Venn diagram of Press Play public radio and surfing.
2% say they surf all the time, 10% say they surf sometimes, 19% say, well, I'm not really that into it, 69% have never tried surfing.
And that was a poll of just six people, so that's
wonderful. No, it was a poll of plenty of people.
Anyway, thanks so much for that.
Sure.
And before we go, I did just want to remind you, it being the season of giving back, there is a great way you can do that. You can join, renew, or upgrade your membership here at KCRW. And when you do today, you can select the LA Regional Food Bank and support two important community institutions with a single tax-deductible gift. So give today at kcrw.com/join. And thank you so much.